Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, I think one of the joys in life for me is to be outside, and especially when there's no traffic and maybe I'm in a woods or I'm just walking through my neighborhood early in the morning, as I do most mornings, and hearing the birds' songs. And there's such a variety of songs that I hear and I enjoy. And I bet you enjoy hearing those songs as well. There's been some really cool research done on bird calls, bird songs, and really bird songs that are heard around the world. And one of the people who's done that work is Sathya Chandra Sagar. Sagra. Oh my goodness. I here I even practiced that beforehand and I still got it wrong.
No, you didn't. That's perfect. It's quite a long name. So,
well, I tell you what, Sathya, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Sathya is a conservation scientist. He's a field ornithologist and a recent PhD graduate from the UW-Madison's Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, and is the lead author on this fascinating global study of bird songs. And I hope you'll join in. We'll hear a few bird songs along the way, but if you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join in. Number's 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Welcome to the show, Sathya. How did you get interested in birds and bird songs?
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Larry. Yeah, this is a pleasure to be here. And yeah, similar to you, I've always loved birds, and my introduction to ecology and conservation and, you know, my life itself as a scientist dates back to the time when I listened to birds. And I was always fascinated by them. And finally, after, you know, nearly 26 years, I think I got this opportunity to kind of use, science to look at, you know, why bird calls, or why does it sing a certain way, and how can that be used, you know, in conservation of theirs. So, yeah, that's how it started.
And it's a really interesting idea. And this is a remarkable, I think, global study.
Yeah.
How the heck were you running all over the world capturing bird songs? I don't think so.
No, definitely not. No, this study that we conducted, I was the lead author, as you said, but also this was a collaborative effort between people like Anna Pigeon, Maya Pershey, Akash, Ben. They were all from UW-Madison, and Chan from Utah, and my advisor, Zuzana Burivalova. And none of us went around the world collecting all the bird songs. But in fact, we used a fantastic, data set that is actually collected by the community scientists, or, previously called as citizen scientists, who are just birders and who are not professional ornithologists, but probably better birders than many scientists, and went out and collected data for nearly 8,000 or 9,000 species of birds all over the world. And it's freely available in an online platform called Xenocanto. And that's the only reason why I was able to do such very global research.
So Xenocanto is, I guess you'd call it a bird watching repository.
Yes, it's like a bird, like a bird recording repository, I would say. Yes. You know, people collect information on their calls and songs and then put it there. And then there are volunteers who go through these songs to see to create them about, you know, what quality it is in, and A being the highest and DE being not the best. And it's out there for people to use it and listen to it and enjoy, and like me also with enjoying studying them. Yeah.
So why do birds call?
I mean, for a variety of reasons, I guess. I mean, you know, there is research has gone to say, why do they call and want to make territory, saying that this is my place, you know. So I'm here, and to show their presence to another males to say that don't come into my territory. And also to show to the female, saying that, well, I'm here and look it out and check it out. But also sometimes I think philosophically they just do it because they love. Also, I think because, you know, the way we sing sometimes and we talk to the world. And I think there's also an aspect of that.
I agree with you. I mean, I sometimes observe birds singing, and to me it looks like they're just for the joy of it.
Yeah, they're having fun. Yeah, that's true.
So why is it important to study?
We knew that, you know, birds are singing, and there's a whole field of bioacoustics, which is basically trying to use the sounds of the nature to study either the landscape or the forests. And our group I was part of, Zuzana Burivalova's Sound Forest Lab, uses bioacoustics, where we collect the sounds of the forest or collect the sounds of the landscape, to know whether it's healthy or not, to conserve it, to understand it. And bird songs are a big part of this soundscape per se, which is like all the sounds in the landscape, right? But while we knew that, you know, like sounds of birds is a big part of the soundscape, but we didn't really know what are those traits that underlie the wide variability. Like, why can't all the birds sing at the same frequency, for example? Like, why should they have different frequencies? And what are those evolutionary factors and ecological factors that shape this frequency differences and this diversity that birds have? And then, you know, so before I used these bioacoustic tools to study how good the forest is, I wanted to study why they are like that, so that I can use it in the conservation of the forest. So that was my first goal. And
you talk about frequency character. I've read some of your writing on that. You talk about frequency characteristics.
Yes. Yes.
So what does that actually mean? Describe what that means.
Yeah, well, frequency characteristics, here we use something like a minimum frequency. Like, you know, if a bird sings, it always has a range of frequencies. You know, many of the species have multiple songs or, you know, a range of frequencies. So we used some of the chosen ones, like the minimum frequency, the lowest of the frequency, maximum frequency, which is like the highest, and the dominant frequency, where there's a lot of frequency characters, you know, frequency energy. And then we also looked at the range, you know, like the difference in the minimum to maximum, how wide that is, basically to look at do they have a huge range, for example? Mm-hmm. So these are the characteristics that we analyzed.
It's interesting. I think today a lot of this type of this research, I'm not sure how precise or possible it could have been maybe 30 years ago. I mean, the equipment that we have, what you were using, some pretty sophisticated sound equipment, I'm assuming.
So I think there's two aspects of it. One is the sound equipment that was used by the recorders, like the people out there recording. And that has, developed quite a bit. The reason why we're having such clarity of voice, like yours and mine, being, recorded right now. And at the same time, I think the computational power with computers and analysis that we can do with these have just been amazing. So I think there's been no better time where we can use this amazing naturalistic data set that collected by these people with the computational power to understand these global patterns.
So all these 8,000 species, yeah. I'm thinking of just how difficult it must have been, or how did you go about separating out this of all of these species, or did you zero in on just some of the 8,000, or was all of the 8,000?
No, it was. I mean, there are about 11,500, odd species, and we focused only on about 8,900 because we could not get the and so we did focus on 8,900. It was 77% of species, But also, we were not just randomly looking into, you know, what we can find from the data, but we had a specific hypothesis that we wanted to test, because I'm not the first person who has tried to, you know, disentangle this. So, you know, for over a century, people have been wondering, like, what is the relationship between how big of a bird is and their call? And does the beak size affect the calls? And whether there's a difference in call frequency characteristic between tropics and temperate regions. You know, so many of these things people have pondered over the years. So I wanted to kind of try to get an answer for that.
Well, Surya, did you find any find birds making sounds in surprising ways, or ways that were surprising to you, at least?
Well, yes, there were like surprising, you know, kind of results. But and some of the things that I already hypothesized, you know, for example, one of the things was, we were thinking, well, you know, a bird will, like a large bird, will always call in a lower frequency, is what we had assumed. And after looking at 8,000 species, we found that, yes, they do. That if, you know, there's a strong relationship between body size and the call frequency. And at the same time, we also found that there's something called, you know, acoustic size exaggeration. Is when like a smaller bird wants to show off, saying that it's quite larger than it is. So it makes an effort to reduce its call frequency so that other individuals or other species that are listening to it will realize, oh, okay, that must be a really large bird. So that acoustic size exaggeration was found by a few species before. But then now with this large data set, we realize that, well, there is a lot of evidence for this to be shown across the board of species, and that was quite fascinating. So to see that.
Sathya Chandra Sagara, our guest today, and we're talking with him about his research, along with some other people, of bird songs and birds, bird talk, I guess you could say it in a way. 8,000 species of birds they've analyzed, and they've got some really fascinating results. We'll hear some of those sounds coming up, and also I want to look at the takeaways eventually from all of the research, because I think that is really fascinating to me. You can join in, question, comment. Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. We're looking into some research that has been done on, well, actually a global study of bird songs help us explain the reasons why these sounds are made. And our guest today was the leader, certainly the leader of the research on it, Sathya Chandra Sagara, our guest today. And I'm having some fun listening to him. I hope you are as well. Michael emailed to ask about birds that mimic other birds that mimic the sounds of machinery, like the superb
lyrebird. So there are a lot of species that do mimic, and they are fantastic. And I know, like, so there are species that mimic other bird songs. There are species that mimic, as you said, you know, machinery and fire. And I think it all happens in their repertoire itself, you know, like it becomes part of who those species are. Not all of them can mimic, and some can and some do. And that, you know, and however, like, I was also fascinated by these birds, because they can mimic, but at the same time, they can't mimic, you know, super high variability, for example, you know, like, yeah. you know, these lyrebirds might not be able to do a frequency as low as, for example, an ostrich, you know, is it super low frequency, or a very high frequency like some of the hummingbirds that we have. So But yeah, they do
within,
mimic
within their range.
Yes, but some birds do push the limit of range, and what we say with what we have done in our study is not look into like species by species, but more of a general pattern across the world. So there is quite a bit of variation, you know, when we look at this pattern. So it would not be wrong to say that that lyrebirds do fall into that category of ooh, they are specialty, you know. Like we know that birds tend to have a certain range, but these might have a huge range. Yeah.
Colleen emailed to ask why robins seem to have a song for when it's raining. That's interesting. I hadn't noticed that.
That's well, I guess I mean they do sing when, you know, when it's raining or not raining, and I'm not very sure whether they have a special song while during singing, but possibly they do, and I'm not very sure. Sorry about that. But I definitely, possibly something, a really amazing research project to look into in the future. Yeah.
Well, habitat, you did kind of, in a way, study habitat. And how can habitat influence the calls that birds make?
Yeah, so the initial hypothesis that we wanted to test was something called acoustic adaptation hypothesis, meaning, you know, there's been these theories that, well, the density of a landscape where a species is, will that kind of force the species to have a certain kind of frequency? Like a very dense habitat, you know, might, you know, a species might want to have a low frequency or a high frequency or something like that. And we wanted to test that relationship. But what we found was the vegetation density is not a big factor. However, what we found out that irrespective of the vegetation density, just the habitat itself does make a big difference. One of the things that we saw was, for example, you know, species that are associated with riverine habitats, like stream gorgers or mm-hmm. right next to streams, they tend to have a really high frequency, and it makes sense. You know, for example, you know, you are walking in a woodland, for example, in the Baraboo mm-hmm. Hills, and you're going closer to the stream gorge, and that's where you'll tend to hear like really high frequency species like winter wren, for example. And this is because the ambient sounds, like the streams, have a very low frequency sound, like the ambient noise itself. So these species want to stand out, you know. They don't want to talk amongst each other with the same frequency. So they want to be loud and say, well, I'm still here despite the background sound. So in a way, that does make a big difference.
I bet Lee's got a winter wren song. Have you got the...
Yeah.
Yeah? Yeah, that's a different frequency.
Yeah, it's just amazing frequency. Yeah.
Compared to like a rushing water.
Yep. Yeah. Compared to definitely, because if it's a rushing water and a species has the same frequency, then it's
not going to be heard.
It's not going to be heard. No, definitely not. So I think so. Yeah. So maybe the question from Colleen, I think, you know, uh-huh. saying that so the rain does have an ambient sound. You know, so yeah. It does have a rustling sound. It does have a thundering sound that kind of muffles the sound at the back. And robin, if it wants to show off and I'm still here and I can still change my voice modulation, it might change its frequency. And birds tend to do that. You know, they can change their, you know, they can use at a higher frequency within their range. But they can tend to use their higher frequency call notes or low frequency call notes in their repertoire to show off, saying that, well, you know, it's raining, but I'm still here.
That's a really good point. Willem in Colfax has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I always look forward to in the spring when the return of, we have a brown thrasher that always returns to the same oak tree, it seems like. And they make such a long string of calls that I think are in the, I think they might be mockingbirds in the group, and they just, it goes on and on, and it's so beautiful.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, they are fantastic. I mean, brown thrashers have an amazing repertoire of calls and songs, and certainly one of the best here in the temperate regions.
We might even have a brown.
beautiful.
Yeah. Beautiful. There you go. Well, I mean, you got to hear them again.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Ed in Central Wisconsin called but couldn't stay with us. But Ed said they used to hear more frequently whippoorwills. And are those birds on the decline? And I believe they are.
Yeah, and I think this brings to this whole topic of, like, you know, conservation, the threats that these birds are facing. Is, I think for me, there are the two different things. Like, for example, like a person who just texted, and I think it, you know, you're not just connected to the landscape just through the forest of just the stones and the grasslands, but also through the sounds of the landscape. You know, when you lose a whippoorwill, you also lose the whippoorwill song. And that means that there's a big part of you, your presence there also is lost due to the loss of that species. And this is happening all over the world. I mean, whippoorwill's population is going down because of the habitat loss that they depend on. And the same thing we hear reverberate all over the world. I mean, sometimes in really good forests, we are also losing these amazing species because they sing well. Like, for example, in Southeast Asia, I mean, I'm giving examples of all over the world because of the global study, that in Southeast Asia, you know, already species are losing their habitat. And what's left of the habitat where the species have to be present, we are losing these, you know, beautiful songbirds because of pet trade. The people there love the bird songs, like the callers today, so much that they want to keep the birds as pets, wild birds as pets in cages. And so you have this double problem for these species. You're losing the habitat, and also the forests are empty and silent. It's very eerie because when I was there studying bird songs in the landscape and how that pet trade is affecting them, there was nothing. It was silent in many places, you know. So it's so nice to come, you know, come here and go to a forest and at least you know hear a brown thrasher, for example, or a winter wren. Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking about this too. If you if there's an area that has always had certain types of birds residing there, and suddenly you're not hearing those anymore. I mean, habitat may be the issue, but it could be something else too.
Yep, that is true, and that's exactly you know, how bioacoustics, like, you know, is used to study a problem. I mean, you know, it's like just like us, you know, if you're in a house and if you're hearing your mom or dad talk, or your, you know, sister or brother, you know that they're present. But if they're not speaking or talking, then they're not there. That something is wrong. I mean, they have gone out, for example, or, you know, they're just not present. So it's the same for a habitat. You know, when you listen to them, if the species that were there all the time are lost, if the habitat is lost, yes, that's one reason. But also climate change right now is a big, big issue. The habitat could be same, you know, it's changing slowly, but species might not cope up with that rising temperature. So they might move to a different place, or there could be mismatch in what they eat, for example, the phenology. So there is this wonderful bird songs all over the world that really make us happy, but at the same time, we are losing this amazing diversity of bird songs. Yeah.
Michael emailed to say that European starlings sing at frequencies above what people can hear. Do the recording devices that are designed for humans capture those very high frequencies?
Yes, there are birds and there are species out there that do, you know, sing and make vocalizations above, you know, hearing frequencies. You know, so we as humans, normally, we can hear from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz, but above that would be ultrasonic. And yes, we might not be able to hear, but there are recorders and microphones out there that can record these calls and songs. And for example, most of the bats use ultrasonic, and elephants use infrasonic. So, that we do. we can listen to them and we can record them.
And just as commenting, Beverly emailed to say, robins definitely have a rain song. They said they've heard it many times when it rains. And I think your response or your comment on the sound pattern, the acoustical pattern that's going on would force them to do that.
Yep. I think so. I think, that's fantastic. Yeah. It's amazing that, that's the beauty of birds being there, and also our connection with the birds is that, now when you're out there, if, for example, if you hear a bird with a higher frequency, you can say that, this could be a smaller bird species because of this study that we have done, or there could be, or if you're walking in the woods and you hear a, sound with, which is a very low frequency, and you could possibly say that could be a very large bird, like a crane or something, or, definitely not a winter wren.
Let's take a large bird. Let's see, great hornbill.
Oh, yes, fantastic.
Found in Southeast Asia.
Yep.
Just sort of a series of deep, what would you call it, grunts?
Yep.
What's going on with that, or why do they do it that?
If you get an opportunity to have a look at them live or online, I mean, these are great hornbills. They're fantastic birds. They're really big, canopy birds, and they in the frugivores, and also they eat insects and other meat, and they're really quite large birds. So. And have really quite a big bill. So that is a classic example of what is happening here, right? Because it's a large bird, it's the frequency that it's using is quite, low. And it helps it to kind of have have this bird song heard at a very, wide range, because it needs that very high, large tracts of forest. And at the same time, its beak is also very big. And that also independently, without even the effect of body size, the beak itself makes a big, difference in what frequency you can call with. And what we found was larger beaks tend to be irrespective of your body size, independent of your body size, you will be forced to have a very low frequency. And so that's why, great hornbills, when you listen to them, you will not mistake them for a winter wren, for sure, because they have a very low frequency, very loud, but very low. Yeah. Very reverberating also.
I was trying to think of some other pileated woodpeckers. They have a little bit longer beak or a different shape beak, and their sound is
quite different, and it is loud, but also it has a very kind of a lower frequency when it compared to other woodpeckers, for example, like a downy or a hairy. So
beak size in this case may be the reason for the lower sound.
And still, pileated is still a smaller bird when you compare to the larger birds out there, So, yes, beak size does make a big difference in what low.
Sounds like they're laughing.
Yeah, they're like, well, you'll still not be able to find out, they're just laughing at us because we are not able to find out all the secrets that they have.
Well, it's interesting. So is the shape of the beak then?
It's the
not only the length but the shape?
Yeah, it's the overall size. So we measure it as length by breadth by height, how big the beak is. So it's like the overall volume of the beak. So it was like how big the beak would be, for example. Yeah.
I'm thinking of another bird that has the loon. And actually, Bob and Mercer said in northern Wisconsin, loons, they're common in most lakes.
Yep.
And their call is particularly...
Yep.
And that's as opposed... There's another kind of a warble that they do, which I think is...
Yep.
There's nothing like listening to
There's nothing like listening to loons. I think it's fantastic. And it's
so yeah. do birds have vocal cords?
They have syrinx, yes.
They have what? I'm
so
sorry.
What do you mean, sorry? Vocal cords. Yes, they do. They do have a bird version of vocal cords called syrinx. So this let these birds to kind of make these sounds by reverberating the bones there, just like shake in such a way that you can make these sounds.
Okay, so it's all right. So that's obviously quite different from what we've got.
Yeah, yeah.
Karen in Rice Lake has something. Let's go there. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I don't know where I heard this, but it was that bird songs affect our nervous system as people and then other animals possibly as well as a signal of safety. And then when the birds go quiet, we automatically are aware that something has changed or there may be danger. Could be a weather change or that a predator is near.
Huh. Quite interesting.
I think they might. Well, you know, if I thought someone was looking for me,
yeah, I mean,
like a hawk.
I'd
be quiet.
Well, I mean, there is, there are quite a lot of songbird species that don't call during a certain time of the time, and there are some, you know, there.
Nope.
So. Sorry.
No, that's right.
So there are some instances where birds might not call and sing because of the low pressure system when there's a approaching storm or something like that. So they might not be calling. You know, that's something that we have observed. And so a predator for a bird could be a different for a predator for a human, mm-hmm. So yes, as you said, a hawk might be approaching or something else, so they might stop some calling.
And then other birds, let's take wild turkeys. Now here in Wisconsin, we have a lot of turkeys,
which is good. Yeah.
And they will call. They have different calls depending on. Well, that's a gobbler.
And
they will have different calls sometimes to attract.
Yeah, so sometimes to attract a mate, and also sometimes as a warning call, which is some species go silent, and some species actually let out this warning call saying that yes, I can see the predator. I'm alerting the other species that are around. And interestingly, we did not use the calls of these species to do this study, so it was majorly on songs. But calls and repertoire of calls also are a big part of these species.
Mark emailed to ask if birds ever lose their voice when they catch a cold or something. Do they get laryngitis?
Like syringitis. I think sometimes they do lose their voice. I mean, it is all anecdotal, by the way. We do have a catbird that sings next to our house the whole night and even early morning, and I have no idea why. I mean, we know why, but it sings so much that at the end of the summer sometimes it just has such a harsh voice, and we are like, it's okay, just relax. It's after the breeding season, so you can relax now. But it's like all harsh and scratchy. So I mean, I know that I shouldn't be talking about anecdotal evidence, but sometimes
right.
You just look at these things and you're like, I think they might. It does put a lot of pressure on their syrinx, and it does put a lot of pressure on their body system when they are calling. And there is something called environmental stress hypothesis, is that some individuals which are not fit enough might not call the same way than the same within the same species.
Yeah.
If one individual is living in the forest that has amazing food structure and amazing food and habitat, they might be fit enough to call louder and call for longer and call more times than the individuals that might be in a next door forest but might be disturbed and not have enough food. So, in a way, how we are and how fit we are does affect and how much we can call and how loud, you know, we can call. And yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. Bob in Sparta Bob has a whippoorwill behind his home that calls constantly and won't go away, depriving them of sleep.
I think it does. They might call a long time, and you know, it does deprive you of sleep. But sometimes I feel like, you know, I think people might lose their sleep over not listening to them. And I think that is something that, because then you can't get the species back. And I think that's more scary for me. Like, I might get annoyed by this, you know, one bird calling, you know, for example, the catbird that calls all the time. But I know that I will lose more sleep when I not listen to the catbird, because I know something has happened to them. And, yeah. And I think that's more scary. And I don't know.
That's a good point. Yeah. Christina in Glenwood City has something. Let's go there. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I am responding to the question about birds losing their voice. I have a canary, Sonny is his name. He has an incredibly beautiful voice.
Oh, fantastic.
However, when he molts once a year in July, he loses his ability to sing. He tries, but he cannot until he's done with his molting.
Wow. That's a fantastic observation. Wow, that's amazing.
It's something it's nothing that you've looked at.
No.
All
yeah. Well, that's amazing. Wow, yeah, there'll be some. Wow, that is fantastic.
Thank you, Christina.
Yeah.
Appreciate the call.
Yeah.
And you could join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about bird songs today, and some global research led by our guest today, Sathya Chandra Sagra, about bird songs and their meaning and how they vary depending on the bird species. It's been great talking with him today. And you can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. We had a song, a male ostrich has a very distinctive warning call. Ooh, ooh, ooh.
That's a fantastic call. I mean, you know, like, it's a very, very low frequency call, and you can hear that for kilometers, you know, and they live in such, you know, harsh conditions and in such open landscapes that they want to communicate with very, you know, various different species, so various different individuals of the same species. So they're like, well, you know, so that's a classic physics, right? If you sing at a very high frequency, the noise, the sound doesn't travel for further. So what it wants is, it wants to make a really low frequency sound. So the low frequency sound travels much further. And thanks to its amazingly large body size, it can make this really low frequency sound. And
it's also flightless. Would that play would a flightless, and would there are other flightless birds, I guess?
Yes, yes.
I wonder if that was, if it might be, it's not unique at all to flightless birds?
You know, it's a great question, Larry.
Because
and
they
I don't
away from danger.
Yeah, and I don't think I did not test that hypothesis, and I don't know whether that can hold good everywhere, but I don't know. I'll look into it, but definitely there are high frequency, smaller birds that are flightless in islands. So I don't know whether this is a specialty, but yeah. Yeah.
Roger in Sun Prairie has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Roger.
I got two things for you, Larry Mueller. One is, can you play the call of an ostrich or an emu or both? But the big thing I wanted to call about is, you're earlier in the program, you were talking about birds losing their voice. Well, the turkey in the spring will gobble, and they gobble so much that towards the end of the breeding season, they barely can gobble at all. And we'll just, with the turkey, they have a real deep early, and then at the end, it's just.
Well, Roger, you might have just missed it because you were getting online, but we did just play an ostrich call.
Yeah, we did. That was fantastic. coincidence. Wow.
I heard the turkey gobble, but not the end of his voice range when he ran out of gobble. So I didn't hear that.
Okay. Oh man.
But that's amazing. I mean, that you're able to, like, I mean, this is a fascinating thing about, like, you know, people loving bird songs. You go out and listen to them, and I think it just is magical. You know, I think it's,
Travis in Madison has something, too. Let's go there. Hi, Travis.
Hey, how's it going, gentlemen? I was just curious. You guys were talking about turkeys and stuff, and as a turkey hunter and stuff, I always thought it was fascinating that turkeys and crows have a relationship where they'll either check out a crow call if you make a crow call as a hunter, or vice versa. They kind of communicate with each other, and I thought that was always interesting, but didn't know much about it, and I thought maybe you guys might be able to tell me more.
So I should be honest and say I do not know these kind of relationships, particularly with a crow, with a turkey here. But however, those kind of mutual relationships does exist. And it doesn't mean I don't know them. I'm sure there are, like, people who might have studied this kind of relationships, but species, like, for example, in Asia and Africa, there are species like drongos. They make a warning call, and based on these calls, there are other species that either go out when there are, you know, no predators, for example, and they go out and, you know, are leisurely hunting and eating other things. But when the drongo makes a call and all the other animals are like, oh, you know, there's a falcon coming, or there's a hawk or an eagle, so let's just go back. So, yeah, so there is this mutual relationship between, you know, birds and other species, for example, meerkats. Yeah, so I wouldn't say no that this kind of exists, you know, a relationship doesn't exist. But I'm not very specifically don't know anything about, but it's fantastic to know. I think it'll be awesome to see. Yeah.
One of your takeaways from your research was that bird species living at the same latitudes make similar sounds.
So what the extension of that kind of...
Because you had a global study, so you were looking at latitudes.
Yeah, yeah. So what the extension of that kind of the thought was that that amongst, you know, like, species across the tropics will have very similar kind of, you know, like a frequency range, you know, like, or frequency bandwidth, what we could say. And that bandwidth, which is similar across the tropics, will be very different in the temperate regions. So what we found was the bandwidth of the birds that are found in the tropical landscapes are much smaller than the bandwidth that we found of the species in the temperate landscape, like in Wisconsin or, compared to Costa Rica, for example. And we were like, you know, it makes sense. But one of the reasons that we got, you know, we thought was because of the high species diversity. You know, like Costa Rica or Panama or, for example, you know, parts in India have 2,000 species, 3,000 species of birds. And not, you know, not every bird can have different, there's only so much bandwidth that is exist that, you know, we can hear, you know, even the birds can listen to. So because of this high species diversity, they are always, you know, trying to have a very small niche, I would say, or a small bandwidth. It's like a symphony, for example. You know, if an orchestra has lots of equipment, all of them will play in a very, you know, very set frequency. But if there are only two people, three people playing instruments, you can play drums in a very low or, like, you know, high frequency. So and I think, you know, on a keyboard, for example. So I think that is what's happening. So more species, they all want to adjust. So and across, and that's, you can see that across you know, the tropics or across the temperate. Yeah.
Here's something interesting. Michael emailed to ask, can researchers estimate the frequencies produced by extinct birds larger than living birds, such as moas or elephant birds, terror birds?
That's a fantastic question. And I think, I mean, the science has gone so much that we could potentially say what frequencies that they are doing based on their bone structure or based on the size. And, you know, we could come to a point where this is the frequency that they're using. But what, I'm sorry, I'm going back again to the conservation of this and the loss of these species is because, for example, you know, like a dodo, you know, was still alive until recently, until we drove them to extinction. We could potentially say what frequency they were calling in, but we'll never know the song of the dodo because that modulation that it might be doing, the complexities that it might be bringing in. And I think that is lost forever. And I think yes and no. So one way we can know the frequency, but we can't really know how beautiful that song, what that bird could do with just that frequency, you know. And I think that's beautiful. And I think also it's lost. So, yeah.
And Cheryl in Bessemer, Michigan, had a comment on brown thrashers, but just the smaller bird species. Why did they have a much wider range of frequencies? And you kind of went on, it talked about that a little bit, but maybe expand on that for us. You know, the more vulnerable birds tend to have a wider range.
Yeah. So the smaller, so what we found was like the smaller birds tend to kind of also, while they are, you know, through the body mass and beak size, they tend to have higher frequency notes, but they also try to make lower frequency calls, lower than what you would predict, you know, what their song would be. And that is just, you know, that is one of the hypotheses called is size exaggeration, you know. So, and I think if you're exaggerating your size, because over the years, species adapt to a certain rhythm of the nature. You know, they'll know that, okay, that call or that song at this frequency means, you know, it could be an ostrich or a large bird. But, and in nature, it's always a race for survival. You know, it's always a race for survival. So in a way that, you know, in that race, they're trying to be like, okay, you know, we could make ourselves look or seem bigger, despite not being. And I think, you know, that's fascinating. And I think that shows the complexities of these.
Well, in our last minute or so, what's next for you here? I mean, I'm sure you've got so much data to work with.
Yeah, and I think one of the next things that we are trying to do is relate these frequency characteristics to their threatened status. You know, someone just asked about the extinct species, and we are trying to see if, like, critically endangered or endangered birds, do they seem to have a certain frequencies, you know? So this comes with an hypothesis that usually large-bodied species tend to be more threatened towards extinction, either because they need, they have very large life cycles or need large habitats to survive, or they're good meat. So a lot of people have hunted down to extinction or to being very endangered. So we're trying to see if, just by looking at the species frequency in a forest, can we say, well, these groups of species that are having, for example, low frequency might be more threatened, is something that we want to do in the future. And and another one would be to try and understand not just the frequency characteristics, but also the temporal characteristics. You know, now we just looked at the frequency, but we can see how the rate of complexity changes. So that's the next.
That's the next. Satya, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And I hope we have a chance to do this again. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for all the listeners. And it's been a pleasure of mine to study the birds and also share this wonderful story. Thank you so much.
Satya Chandra Sagra, our guest today, conservation scientist and recent PhD graduate from the UW-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Pleasure to have him with, and a pleasure to have you listening in, and thanks so much for listening. And stay with us. Lots more in store on WPR News.